Okay, welcome everybody, most of you online. So I'm Jussi Toppari. We saw in the first lecture, actually on the previous lecture also, yes, on your presentations. And so I'm continuing basically where the guys was left. And today we talk about a little bit more like a physics-oriented, well, I wouldn't say maybe not so much physics-oriented, but it is kind of traditionally thought as a physics area, this nanofabrication. So this is mostly what we are now dealing is kind of traditional nano and microfabrication. Okay, something. Yes, now it works. Okay, so this is just to remind you what you should know already from Kaisa's lectures, something. And so about scaling laws, how to get things smaller, and what are the benefits, what are the differences when you go smaller, and about the molecular interaction of your molecular machines and this nanoscale. And you were also talking about some solid states, so materials, especially nanoclusters. And of course, molecules and atoms, they are material also, but if you talk about solid state, you usually mean this kind of big bulk or something. We are not talking about big bulk, since we are talking about nano, but now we are talking about how to get this big bulk piece of material to nanoscale, how to make your nano devices out from that. And so this is a brief outline. First, what is a nanofabrication? Then something about clean rooms, lithography methods, growing films, etching. If you don't know what this means at the moment, you will soon. Then also bottom-up methods. And at the end, we go a little bit out of nanofabrication scanning to scanning broad microscope. This is important tool. It's not just for imaging, it's also for fabrication and even for measurements. So that's why we go with more throughout through. So basically, what is meant by nanofabrication? So this is any method to squeeze your lump of solid state material to something below 100 nanometer. This is so small that I cannot show it. Basically, the nearly basically all nanomaterials in the research and development needs this kind of nanofabrication methods at some point. You can combine with other things which we will go also through. But especially in modern technology, this nanofabrication or nano and microfabrication is really the basis. Everything is based on that. And of course, ultimate goal is control matter at the atomic scale. And there's basically two ways to reach that goal. So I think this is something Kaisa mentioned already, if I'm correct. But just to remind you, so top down means that you take a big piece of material like a wood in this picture, and you make a cut out of that or somehow modify it to the smaller dimensions. And this is mostly physical nanofabrication methods. Then there's a bottom up, which means like a Lego city here, so you take more pieces of material, more pieces, and put them together to make big things out of that. And this is mainly chemical and biological nanofabrication method. Of course, this division to chemical and biological and physical, it's not exact. It's just about what the most of the method is based on. As you see, they are very well mixed. So I already mentioned modern technology. So here, if you take, for example, you rip out from your computer or processor, don't do it now because we have a lecture, and you cut it, what you see is this kind of structure inside. Of course, first thing what you see is this kind of circuits everywhere. So this is your processor and this is coin of some other country. And if you then take this kind of a processor and make a short cutting here with a very sharp knife and look from a side, this is what you see. So there's a big, many, many, many layers of wires. And usually these are copper interconnects. So these are just wires. And the active part is here, where you can see the name transistors. So here all the transistors are side by side. And this is a zoom out of one transistor. Ah, you can't see my cursor. Then probably nobody else will see it either.
Yeah.
Good. Thanks. Yes. Wait a second. I make it actually bigger and then I just need to... Now you see it.
Yes.
Okay, good. So I was pointing many times already and nobody probably saw it. So there's a transistors here, and this is a zoom out from one of a transistor, looks like a teeth, if you have seen this dentist picture. But this is a one transistor. Its size is about 42 nanometer. We will look a little bit transistor later. So it's really small nowadays. And this picture is actually from 2014, so it's already old technology. So nowadays you have even more interconnects and your transistor is, I think, nowadays 17 nanometer. Okay. If you think the air you're breathing now, of course here in Finland is pretty clean, but there's a lot of stuff. Ambient air typically contains, so there's 35 million particles per cubic meter, which are larger than a half a micrometer. The smaller particles, there's even more. And if you think your nanofabrication, your transistor was like 42 nanometer. And if there's millions of particles which are 10 times bigger than your transistor. So you can imagine what kind of bombardment happens at your device. So every once in a while, some of these particles hit your device, and this is, you can compare it like a meteor hitting the planet. So it's really big. So it's 10 times bigger than your device. So basically, it will destroy it in the worst case. And does this mean that a nanofabrication is kind of impossible? And if you look here, here's a kind of a map of what you can find in the air, what you are breathing at the moment. So there's a dust, small dust, bigger dust, and even bigger. So settling dust means this dust is all already collected to the tables and every surface you have. Suspended atmospheric dust means a dust what is just floating around, which never settles anywhere, but you just happily breathe. Then there's a lot of biological stuff, mold, hopefully not at your home, but there's a house dust, and of course bacteria. And now what we are trying to avoid a lot, so viruses. And these are kind of the same size than this dust, which never settles. So viruses never settle by themselves on the surface at least not very easily. And of course, there's kind of this kind of particles, smoke. Tobacco smoke is also here, very bad. Oil smoke, fly ash. And then, of course, gases, contaminants. So these are usually just so different gases in the atmosphere. Usually not harmful for nanofabrication, but maybe for you. So how to deal with this problem? So that's why we have so-called clean rooms. And you can see the models, they're standing in a clean room. So you have this kind of a special spaceman looking suit, which is made from a fabric which doesn't generate dust. So I don't remember exact number, but with this kind of a shirt and me standing here, I'm generating maybe 2 million particles per second. So this is a lot. So the biggest contaminant is yourself. So that's why you need to wear this kind of suit, which doesn't produce dust so much. Of course it does a little bit. And then inside that clean room, there's air circulated. So here you can see this picture. So it circulated out from here at the bottom. Then it's going up through these huge so-called HEPA filters, which are very efficient to filter everything out. And then it's put back in a way that it is, the flow is laminar. So you can see all the arrows here are pointing down. So this means that your air is going as a one kind of one big flow. So there's no turbulence. As soon as there's a turbulence, immediately it starts polluting. Whatever dust you have on the surfaces starts to get off and back to air. But if it's just a laminar flow, it just pushes all the dust particles and whatever you have in the air to the ground. And from ground, it sucked to this ventilation and circulated again. So you can see here the people are generating a lot of dust. And also if you go to see the clean rooms, you can see that this kind of tables here. So if you look them inside a clean room, they are not like a regular table, but they are full of holes. And this is just to keep the flow laminar. As soon as you have something to prevent the flow, flow starts to go around and you get turbulence. But if you have holes full of your desk, it just goes through. Of course, it means that you shouldn't keep small things there because they might also drop. Also, humidity and temperature are carefully controlled. And for example, there's a so-called classification. So this ISO is a ISO classification is kind of the nowadays the most common. And if you think level 5 of that classification, it means that you have only 3,500 particles per cubic meter. That's the maximum you can have. If you have that level. So it means it's 10,000 times lower already. And these are very much used in, of course, everywhere. There's a semiconductor fabrication, also pharmaceutical development, biotech, nanotech. We have a clean room here of about 150 square meters, exactly for nanofabrication. And this is just something you don't need to remember by heart, but just to get your idea. So this is the standardization. So as you can see, this ISO 5 is somewhere in the middle. And as we were talking about particles half a micron or bigger, then the limit is exactly this 3,500, okay, there are 20 more here. Still, even in that clean room, you will have smaller particles quite a lot. And you can push this till one. I have once visited myself in ISO 1 level room, and that was kind of clean room inside another clean room. So when you went to the clean room, you changed your suit, acted, operated regularly. Then you went inside bigger, a smaller room inside and changed the suit again. And that was really like the whole room was just one laminar flow and one device which needed this extra clean environment. So this is not very, I have to say that the cleaner is the clean room, the harder it is to operate and keep clean. So for example, we have a kind of compromise. So we have mostly of this ISO 5 exactly, but some rooms are also ISO 6. So we don't have to wear the full space suit. We don't have a helmet. But if you go to the smaller ones, then you have a really full coverage. Okay, so these are some general things about nanofabrication and how to make it possible environment for that. But how you then do things? So we go some main procedures here. So first we talk about lithography methods, patterning, and I may pose a question here. What is the most common substrate where you start your fabrication? Anyone can
silicon.
Say? Yes, of course, silicon. You all know that your phones, your processors, they are full of silicon. And where does the silicon come from? So basically, if you want your semiconductor device to operate, we go next lecture about what is a doping, if you don't know, but it means that you mix something else with your silicon. It's not the same than a doping in a sport, or it is kind of same to improve the qualities. But now you do it by adding some other material, usually material with a little bit less or a little bit more electrodes. And this dopant concentration, what is required to make these devices, is something about 10 to power of 15 to 20 atoms per square cubic centimeter. And what you want to avoid is a contaminant, whatever contaminant you might get to your silicon. And this is, should be less than 1% of that doping, because the doping atoms are kind of which makes a device to work, and there should be less than 1% of unintentional doping, so this one background contamination. So it means 1% of that, if we take this 10 to 15, for example, as a number, so this means that this contamination should be 10 to power of 13 atoms per cubic centimeter at maximum. Okay, in silicon, there's about 10 to power of 22 atoms per cubic centimeter. This is roughly the same for all materials. It doesn't vary so much. So this means that your impurity concentration should be 10 to 13 divided by 10 to 22, which means 1 billion of parts. So every one atom in a billion atom can be something else than the silicon. Of course, the dope, or it should be something different than the silicon or the doping which you intentionally put there. So this means that your clean room has to be really clean to get that number. So it's really crucial. Here is rod of silicon. This is one crystal of silicon. This diameter, I would say, is about 20 centimeters. So this is certainly more than a meter rod. So these are big pieces. So here you can see wafer, which is cut from this, you just take a saw and you start cutting, and then you polish it. And then you start your nanofabrication and you end up, hopefully, to something like this. So microprocessor. So, and this is how you make this kind of silicon, single crystal silicon. So it's better explained by next slide here. Yeah. But first, where you get the silicon, basically you take a sand outside. Basically whatever sand, there's a lot of sand. And of course, it should be silica sand. So silicon dioxide most, because sand contains other oxides and nitrides also. And some places there's a more silicon oxide than in other places. So you should say a little bit select your place. Then you take a sand and you react the gaseous carbon and you get out of silicon and carbon monoxide. So this is kind of a so-called metallurgical grade silicon. So this is not something what you can use for electronics, but it's basically 98% pure silicon. But as we just noticed, we need much, much more. So there should be 99 point and then 99s after that for purity, what we are aiming. So you react with a hydrochloride acid. So you melt your silicon and you get this kind of compound, which I as a physicist cannot say the exact correct name, chemical name, chemists all know immediately. And you get the hydrogen out. Ah, there is trichlorosilane. I didn't read it, okay? And that you can purify by distillation. So you can just evaporate it and collect it back. And when you collect it, basically you are solidifying it on the top of a silicon. And the reaction is exactly the same on the backwards. So you are adding hydrogen gas and you make a solid. But meanwhile, you are only evaporating this trichlorosilane and other impurities are not evaporated, so they are left out. And so this is really pure electronic grade silicon. But it's still just a piece of silicon, no form, no crystallinity. And for this kind of devices, you want a single crystal, so your atoms are exactly organized to the lattice. So you really want to organize every atom to a single crystal. And before that, it's just some kind of mess. I try to be as random as possible. So that's amorphous silicon. So every atom is wherever. Amorphous material is usually basically for glass. That's a silicon dioxide, but so it's transparent, but that's amorphous. And if you make crystal out from a silicon dioxide, you still have a glass, but a special glass. You probably know the name, quartz. Quartz glass. So it has a much better properties, but it's also much more expensive. So that's why the windows are not made from a quartz glass. So basically the similar operation needs to be done now for a silicon. And how do you do that? You melt your silicon, as in a picture you can see here. This is melted silicon. Then you dip small piece of single crystal silicon on that and slowly start to rise it while you rotate the whole thing. You rotate the ball and you rotate the silicon and you slowly rise it so that it kind of solidifies the single crystal. And if you do that slowly enough, atoms have time to find their places before it goes to solid. So So it kind of recognizes a lattice from a first piece, what you did in, and continues the same lattice. So there's a, this is a basic chicken egg problem. Where did you get the first piece of silicon to make it? Okay, you got it somewhere. Nowadays, that's easy to find. You can find it in any nanofabrication factory. But so this is a basic idea how you make it. Then you have your silicon, you have cut it to the wafer. Yes, you are happy. You can start your fabrication. And what you usually do is this kind of lithography steps. So you make some kind of thin film on top of your device, then you make pattern on it, and then using this pattern, you make etching or deposition. And these are three steps. Basically, you just repeat them many, many times, you get whatever. You probably need to combine it with other methods also in a while. But for usually processor fabrication example, you, I don't know what is the exact number, but it's hundreds times you need these three steps. So it's one of the topic. So somebody will give a lecture of that after 3 weeks. What is exactly needed to make a processor? So I don't go exactly to the processor fabrication more, but let's concentrate about each step more. So let's start about this first step. What you do is you need a resist. So this is some kind of polymer, what you have in a solution. So it's like a liquid, viscous liquid. And when it's dried, it forms kind of a plastic. So it's a plastic looking polymer after that. And you need a very thin layer of that. So how do you do it? You take a wafer like here, put it in a spinner. So this device here is a spinner, and you put your wafer in the middle of that, and you put a drop of your solution there and start spinning. As you know, centrifugal force will spill all your resist out, but there's also surface tension. And also you have van der Waal force and whatever forces to keep the, keep your liquid on the surface. So basically, if you give a certain speed, which is usually more than 1,000 rounds per minute. So if you take a certain speed, at some point you get equilibrium. Sorry. Equilibrium, and your force, centrifugal force is same than the surface tension and surface forces keeping your liquid, and you get even, very even thin film. Of course, there's some edge effects because the surface tension is a little bit different at the edge of a wafer. But basically, almost full wafer is covered with a thin film, with an even thickness, and this you can tune even down to 50 nanometer. So it's really thin. But it can be also thick like a 5 micrometer. It depends what you want to do. And now you have a resist. Why is this important? Because that's exactly your ink. That's your reactive part. Now you do something for it, which is called exposure. So you expose it to something. Usually that's a light. It can be electron beam, it can be ion beam, but it can be also light. And when that happens, there's two possibilities. So here, on left side, we talk about positive resist. So what happens there is that you expose that you expose some region for light or whatever radiation you have. And what happens there is it breaks this polymer chain to smaller pieces. So this crosses means that you cut your polymer chain, which means it's more easily soluble. So now after exposing, you immerse that in developer, and this exposed part will go away, and this blue part is left on your sample. So after that, you have your kind of shape, what you wanted. You can also use negative resist, like here. Then in the areas what you expose, what happens is you make a cross-linking. So you link your polymers to each other. So they have some reaction group, reactive groups which react under exposure, and they make a bigger clumps. So this is harder to solve away. And of course, when you put it in a solvent, the part what you have exposed is left on the surface, and the other parts are taken away. So this is, of course, the choice of a resist depends what you want to do. If you want to expose a small area, you take a positive resist, because it would be stupid to draw everything outside to get them to stay. But if you want to small, only small piece to stay on your chip, then you take, of course, negative resist. So you try to avoid too much exposing. So here's a kind of cartoon of a basic principles of photolithography. So first you have your substrate, and as you can see here, there's a silicon slash silicon dioxide, because very often, for example, what we do here, we don't want a semiconductor as a substrate. We want the insulating substrate. So we have oxidized the top of that. So you basically have a small film of glass on top of your silicon, which is still very flat. So this is actually silicon wafer. They can be polished atomically flat. So basically it means that if you have this lattice kind of structure, you can polish it so that your surface is exactly that. So what you see in a surface is kind of a regular lattice of atoms. Okay, you have your silicon covered with silicon dioxide. You go to your spinner, you spin coat your resist. In this case, it's called photoresist because we are using light. But resist is a common name. Then you do your exposure. You have your light source and you have your mask. Which means that you have this kind of it can be metal, for example, very common. So this very common, this is a quartz glass, and then you have a metal where you have a hole making exactly the pattern you want to do. And then through that, you expose your sample. There can be some optical systems, for example, to focusing the light. So it can be that the mask is like a centimeter and the structure you get here is a micrometer. So it kind of squeezes it down. Or it can be that you put your mask exactly contact on your substrate. It depends. These optical systems, they of course induce some kind of a distortion and so on. So that's why people actually try to avoid it. So basically, and these positions, what you have exposed to the light, there the resist reacts. In this case, we have positive resist, so the chain breaking happens, so they go yellow. And of course, these which are behind the shadow, they are not at all, nothing happens to them. Then you put it to the development, and what happens there is a special solvent. Usually every resist has its own development solvent. And what happens there is that these exposed parts, they are melted away. Then you have your structure. You take it out and dry. Now you have fabricated your nano-sized structure on top of the silicon chip on a resist. Resist is not very useful material to be used later. It can be used in some cases, but not very often. And what do you do then? You use it for something. There's a basic two choices here. You can make additive process, So this means that you take some other method and deposit a layer of some material on top of your chip. Here, the deposition goes everywhere. So you don't need to care where it goes, because this lithography step, your resist takes care of that. So as you can see, in the places where you don't have a resist, it goes to contact with your chip, with your silicon chip. And here, other places, it stays on top of a resist. And what you do next is so-called lift-off process. And this is usually done with acetone, with almost, because that melts almost any resist or any polymer. And what happens? It melts or solvates away the rest of a resist. And of course, the material on top of that will go away also. And now you have your structure with whatever material you wanted. So this is a very common method for metals. Other is method is removable process. You do etching, which means that you, I think there's no better word than etching. You etch away your material, so to solve it. So you put it, for example, in a very strong acid, which melts away your silicon on the places where it's open. Here, the resist will cover it, and it doesn't. It's away. And then, of course, you need to take this resist away. So you dip it to acetone again, and you get rid of your resist. Here it's not called lift off because you are not lifting any other material off. You are just taking your resist away. Now you have nice holes in the silicon. Of course, you could have started from a silicon chip with a thin layer of some other material. And then you etch through this other material. Then you end up to the same result than here. In some cases, that's a better way to make your pattern with some other material. But these are the basic steps you need to use, or you can use. There's actually not very many other choices. And if you think about development of photolithography, which is the most common lithography, so in the 90s, the resolution was there just below micron. And it has gone down all the time, more and more. And what is the basic limit is a diffraction limit. So the resolution of photolithography is limited by the wavelength of the radiation. So there's this famous Abbe's law, which is written on this ball in front of Friedrich Schild University in Jena. I don't know, this probably should not be the statue exactly how Abbe looked, because it's just a ball. It's this kind of big stone ball where is written this law. So D is a dimension you can squeeze your light in. And then there's a wavelength divided by 2 times n times sine the angle. So just to write it also here. And the sine of an angle means exactly this. If you take a light beam and focus it, so it means this angle. Wait a second, is it this angle? Yeah. And then, of course, wavelength of your material and refractive index. So this is limiting. And as you can see here, reducing the wavelength, of course, get you better resolution. But at some point, you hit the limit. So there's this extra UV light, which is 13.5 nanometer wavelength. So this is really, really dangerous light already. But still, that's not actually used very much because it has its own problems. But people are still using this almost 200 nanometer light. But what they are doing, there's another solutions. Okay, reduce wavelength, that's one. Of course, you can increase the refractive index. Increase your N here. So what you do, you take the whole device where you do exposure and dip it in oil. Oil has a high refractive index. Then you get a much smaller wavelength. And then there's this kind of a double buttering phase shift. So you take an interference, so you take two light beams interfering and you can artificially make this kind of interference pattern which can go below the diffraction limit. So there's many tricks to go to this. There's a 22, it was 2012, obviously when I took this picture. There's now 2020. We are not below 10 as this kind of has shown 10 years ago. We are still above 10 up slightly, but we are very close here. Of course, so this is what industry uses. There's another way also, electron beam lithography. So there you take this kind of electron microscope, which you can see here, the cross section. So you have electron gun, which spits out electrons, and they are accelerated by voltage. And then you have this kind of magnetic lenses, which guide the flight of your electrons. And basically, okay, if you just scan your surface and make an image, you get a scanning electron microscope image. You have, everybody has seen one of those at some point. But if you don't, if you stop your scanning and tell the computer to guide your electron beam, you can draw like that certain area on your surface. And of course, that area is then exposed and you can do development. Okay, here it was negative resist, so that part was left. Everything else was sold away. And you get a much, much smaller structures. It's very accurate, you can go even below 10 nanometer. But as you saw, you draw it line by line, so it's very slow, which means it's very expensive. And if you think nowadays processor, which means that you have how many millions of transistors they nowadays have? Tens of millions anyway. So you draw them one by one. So drawing one layer of a processor would take a week. Easy to take a photolithography, make one flash, and that's it. Everything done. So that's why industry don't use this. But this is for research purpose, for example, this is what we use most of the time. And you can, this is nice way to make a mask for your photolithography. Because here you don't need mask. You just need a CAD drawing and computer to make your drawing. And here's a basic calculation, the speed. So there's a dose, what you need to expose, times the area. So this dose is like how many coulombs, so how much electric charge. So you know the charge of one electron, for example. And then there's an area, so there's a kind of your TC supervisor tells you to make this kind of device, which is one square centimeter, and you need, so it's a dose times area is a time times current, because in a electron microscope they always show current, so how much electrons they are putting to your sample. So basically, if you need to calculate your time, you just di divided by I, dA divided by I. And if you put these numbers there, you need millicoulomb per cubic square centimeter. And your area was 1 cubic centimeter. So basically this just goes away. And you divide it by, your ampere is a kind of nanoampere. So this is very common number in electron beam microscope. And what you end up is 10 to the power of 6 seconds. So there's a -3 and there's a -9, so it comes to 6. How many hours is that? Divided by 60, you get minutes, divided by again 60, so let's just make a rough calculation, divide by 100 to get the minutes, so it's 10 to 4 minutes, okay, so this is really not very big approximation, and it's 100 hours. Not very nice job for you. So this really can take a long time. Okay, you maybe not so, but and this was already assumed that the minute has 100 seconds and